You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Jerry Takagawa is my guest. He is a renowned photographer, designer, and writer. His work can be found in many museum collections at San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, Brooklyn Museum, the Crocker Art Museum, Santa Barbara Museum of Art, the Library of Congress, and the Monterey Museum of Art. He's won many awards, and you've seen his work at the Monterey Aquarium. And he's just published Balancing Cultures. It's a book of extraordinary photographs which convey the experience of the Japanese internment during the Second World War. Jerry Takagawa, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, Gary. Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. This book is really beautiful, and I wish that my listeners could see it. I'm going to hold it up to the microphone, but that doesn't do anything. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I want you to describe, if you can, what it is exactly. They are photographs, but they're also objects. I don't know. You do it.
Yeah. Balancing Cultures primarily started out as an identity kind of project, something that I think if I were to go back and look at my career arc, because I recently had a retrospective at the Center for Photographic Art this year, and it caused me to look back at this long 40-year period of doing photography. And the retrospective begins with a series called the Kimono series. And that's probably the first time I really started to embrace the idea that, hey, I'm Japanese. And, you know, it seems sort of weird in a way, but, you know, when I was growing up, because I was born right after the war, and my parents were out of the camps then, they really impressed on me that it was important to be American. And I know, as all parents do, they were really basically trying to protect me from what had happened to them, which was their rights as citizens were totally abolished immediately with that executive order. And so, you know, they're pretty much saying, you know, be American. And so the idea that, oh, I'm also Japanese didn't really come into my expression of artwork until, you know, like the 80s and early 80s even. And so I spent my whole career shooting this work, slowly and gradually integrating the idea of what that meant to be Japanese. And eventually, after, you know, many, many years of using Japanese artifacts and things that, you know, were from my childhood, I decided, you know, maybe I needed to look at this area of my life that was, when I was growing up, essentially a void. In other words, they spoke very little about the camps. And in psychology, basically, silence is an incredible transmitter of, you know, emotion. So, you know, those feelings that they had that they did not really express were being passed on very effectively to myself, I assume my brother as well. So there were times when I would, you know, engage in social documentary work or environmental work, things that, you know, required a voice to maybe support and advocate for various causes. This welling would come up in me, and I wouldn't know really, I never knew really where that was coming from. I just thought it was me reacting to the, you know, what was going on in the world. And I think now, after doing Balancing Cultures, I think a lot of what that was about was my, kind of my parents, even though they wanted me to be American, being American is also, you know, having the freedom of speech. And they never really exercised it so much because they were afraid of retribution. They're afraid of being, you know, that happening again, as they would say. And, so I decided to go into this project, and it was actually really stimulated by the discovery of images, black and white images taken of my parents and my family in the camps, which I had never seen. And it was all after my parents had passed away. And my brother and I found this box of photographs that were from that time period, and we had never seen them. And there was something evidential about seeing a black and white photograph, because, you know, seeing is believing, kind of. And it became very real, and it also kind of instilled in me at that moment, you know, yes, you know, you need to do this project. And I think it probably took me a year to year and a half before I wanted to actually start it, because it was going against, it was like betraying their silence in a way. And so I did a lot of research, and I started to feel a certain amount of, you know, of course, empathy, but also anger about what had happened. And it really was compelling for me to, create this work. And I know that the first few images I created, they had an anger charge in me, but, you know, I'm expressing things in this work in a way that is, would be considered, you know, fine art photography. It's not really documentary. And, it's just its own thing. I mean, it's art, essentially. And it's the way I've done all of my work over the years. And so over the years, I had developed a kind of visual vocabulary that allowed me to articulate what was going on now. And it kind of all makes sense now when I look back and say, yeah, I spent your first 10,000 hours and all that kind of, you know, developing your skills and your vocabulary, and you have a language. So what do you want to say? And, what I wanted to say was, you know, this actually happened to my family, and I don't think it was right.
I mean, there are many, you know, documentaries, both in literature and film, on the internment, but what you've done here, and this isn't simply the photographs that you found, but you've done things to the photographs. You've layered them and changed the focus and placed things on top of them. Can you talk a little bit about physically what you did?
Right. Physically, it all began with the family images that I found. You know, we would take them and print them as background prints, and we would make them out of focus a little bit. I would ask to soften that focus so that when the objects are placed on top of them, the family images feel like they're further in the background, because that's a photographic kind of language, that when you see it out of focus, it's further away. And something is sharp in the foreground. And something in this case, the background photographs are all black and white, and the foreground is natural color. And so there's a kind of immediate dimensionality about it. And the background, you know, I mean, you can ascribe a lot of different, you know, meanings to it. I mean, maybe it's like memory is soft and starting to fade. These objects, I kind of knew that I wanted to use some text-based objects in the foreground. And sometimes they were posters, or sometimes they were letters. Sometimes I would put letters to make statements. But the idea of the text, I would call them breadcrumbs for the audience or the viewer to be able to get a sense of what, you know, the narrative that I was trying to put forth. Because I had been, you know, criticized in the past about things that I've done that seemed maybe they were beautiful, but maybe the impact wasn't there because people didn't quite get the message, which I thought that was, you know, kind of lame. But in the end, you know, it's like art, you know, you need to look into it. But we're lazy as viewers. And so I kind of wanted to, you know, this was important enough that I wanted to give the reader some clues.
The book, it's such a beautiful book, and breadcrumbs is such a great idea. Because you're going on a journey, I'm going to need the breadcrumbs to help me find my way back.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with photographer Jerry Takagawa. His new book, Balancing Cultures, is a book of photographs that reflect his family's history with the Japanese internment during World War II.
Your family's experience, so they wanted to kind of forget it. Do you think that they had more shame than anger as you were growing up about it?
Yeah, I think shame is a big part of it. And I think it was a big part of it for pretty much the whole Japanese community. I mean, you know, to learn about, you know, before they were moved to the camps, you know, you learn about, if you do research, you see the anti-Asian sentiments that were being delivered out there in the world. And it must have felt, you know, I just couldn't imagine how they would feel about it, you know, the sensitivity. And that's part of the emotional, you know, push for me. But shame is essentially, you know, kind of being, feeling less than for actually who you are and not what you've done. I think if you've done something, and you might feel guilt, but when you just are something, you know, yeah. And it's hard to, like, in, you know, other races like the Black race, I mean, it's hard to, you know, kind of disown that appearance because that's who you are. And so basically they were imprisoned because of who they were.
And tell us a little bit about your parents. Where were they before 1941? And when was
well, my parents were, they were both born in Monterey, which is primarily where I grew up. Even though I was born in Chicago, we moved back here when I was five. And so they had gone to high school in Monterey, you know, cheerleader, baseball player. It was an all-American, you know, kind of new life. And my grandparents on my mother's side, you know, they had fish markets and restaurants and hotels, and they were
so both your parents were born in the United States?
Oh yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, my grandparents emigrated from Japan at the turn of the century, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So they were here, my grandparents were here 35 years before the internment happened.
Right. So how old were your parents when the internment happened?
I'm going to guess, shoot, where's my calculator? Actually, I can. So let's see. They were in their early to mid 20s. Mm-hmm. They had just gotten married about 6 months before the order. So they were just starting out on a new...
Yeah.
New life. So
did your family lose property? And
you know, I believe, and this is all I can piece together from my great aunt before she died about a year and a half ago. She lived to like 103.
Wow.
And we would go to lunch, and she said that my uncle, my oldest oldest son on my mother's side, He actually engaged a lawyer to manage the one property they had in Monterey while they were gone, so that, you know, I guess things were paid for, you know, over time, and it didn't fall out of hand. So I think when the war was over and they left the camps, my grandparents were able to come back to a property, which was not always the case. In fact, very often not the case.
Right. Now, when you were growing up, you were saying how they wanted you to be an American.
Yeah.
And you were, you are, but what was it? Were there other, did you encounter racism growing up? Did other kids ever, you know, post-war racism? What about, you know, the term Jap and all the comic books and movie serials and all that? Did you encounter?
You know, honestly, I don't, you know, unless I totally repressed it, I don't remember that kind of distinction, because I think it was well into grade school that I even had a sense that there were different races, you know. And so in, say, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, there were just other kids.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what kids are, I think. And, you know, it does get impressed on, I mean, you get more definition through your upbringing, your parents, basically. And they start to form that awareness of, you know, hierarchies and, you know, this race is better than that race kind of thing, which, you know, which is really just passing on the stereotypes in a way.
So now, and you said you were born after the war, so now you're, you know, a little over 40. Why now are you dealing with this material?
You know, I think, again, I did spend, you know, a 40-year career of making images, working up to, and this is the way it looks from this side. When I was doing it, I don't think I was thinking I was working up to anything. I was just doing what I did at the time. But, you know, I feel now like I was working up to trying to say something, because in the very beginning, before, you know, even before Kimono Series, I really kept asking myself, you know, what is it that I really feel like I need to say something, and what is it that I need to say? And the story goes, now it's like you have to live a certain amount of life and history and have experiences to be able to form opinions about things and then express those things. So it, you know, it was something that if I'd known, I mean, in the beginning, I'm just, you know, getting chops down, basically learning and experimenting and doing all kinds of crazy things in the arts to finally land on something that I feel, you know, is something I can work with, and then develop that over a number of series of different projects to refine that language. So then now I have this vocabulary, and it's time to say something important with it. And I think, you know, I'm part of a group show. I've been part of a lot of group shows of other Japanese American artists, which some of them I've actually been involved as a curator to organize, and some of them just participate in. But, you know, I kind of noticed that, you know, a lot of people in my generation started doing this work, you know, much later in their lives. I mean, there was this, I don't know if it's because parents, you know, had to, you know, get out of the picture in order for this to happen. You know, that happened. That's one way to look at it. But it isn't something that just, you know, kind of was immediately you started doing. I think you had to absorb a lot of what was going on in the world and then see what happened, you know, in retrospect to your own family.
How do you think your parents would feel about this book?
Well, you know, you know, when I've won like three or four different awards for this work. And one of the awards was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And part of that award was, you know, doing a presentation at this event to talk about the work. And when we were in Santa Fe the night before the presentation for me, I had a dream about my father. And you know, he was kind of angry at me. And it was just, you know, how dreams are there. It was totally, everything was out of context. And, but the message I got was that he was kind of upset about it. And again, in the morning and I woke up, I was thinking, you know, gosh, maybe they don't really, they wouldn't want me to say something about this, you know, we're going public on this is what it is. But, you know, after I thought about it for a while, it became clear that he was still trying to protect me. And I guess, you know, it was my choice, my risk. And I decided it was okay. And I honestly think they would be kind of proud of it.
Well, it's an absolutely beautiful book. When did you decide that a book was the best way to handle the work?
Well, you know, it's something I design books for other people as a designer, and done a lot of books for other people. And I have done, you know, small volumes for myself that are usually mostly writings and such. But I think it's important, you know, this work to me was important enough that I wanted to have it continue on in some fashion. And I know that in a sense, it's almost more people see a book than see an exhibition. So, and the book also is the entire collection of those works, where most exhibitions are about two-thirds or, you know, less than all the work. And so it's kind of, you get everything, all the more personal work as well as the things that are more universal. But I was at a they're called the photo reviews, where, you know, they and photographers come to a space, and there are a lot of what I would consider gatekeepers. And there was a group that wanted to publish this work, and they got me going on it. They kind of decided later that it wasn't, you know, they had too much to do and they needed to drop me on that point. But I actually decided to self-publish because I had done all this work to that point. I was ready to go. So having done books for other people, lots of people, it wasn't a problem. And in fact, I was planning to kind of control that part of it anyway. So. And it was also scheduling. I did engage other publishers, but their schedules were such that, you know, it wasn't going to work with my timing. So.
And George Takei wrote a little blurb on the back. How did that come about? Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, you know, I obviously knew about him because he is an activist, of course, in Star Trek and such. But I did ask my friend Larry Oda, who is former national president of the JACL, Japanese American Citizens League, and he had a connection to him, and as well as the museum director for the Japanese American National Museum in LA, and they both kind of went to bat for me. And he was, you know, I was asking him in the beginning maybe to write a foreword, but my schedule was so screwed up that I couldn't give him the right lead time. So I said, you know, I'll come back later and maybe you can do an endorsement. So
that's wonderful. So yeah. Jerry Takagawa, where can people get Balancing Cultures? Where can they find this book?
Well, at current, you know, I have the Japanese American National Museum in LA. They carry the book, and so it's in their online bookstore. And I mean, locally in Monterey, there's going to be some venues. The Pilgrim's Way, you have some books, River House Books, and then the Weston Gallery is going to carry some books. But the other online venue is the Magenta Foundation. They're the people that wanted to publish the book in the first place. They are putting up they're going to put it on their bookstore too, but that hasn't really happened yet. So I'm waiting for them to post that so I can do a launch. I haven't really done a campaign launch yet.
Well, it is an absolutely beautiful work of art, and I'm honored to have a copy of it and to have had, had you here be with me on from the bookshelf. So thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No problem.
Jerry Takagawa. His book, Balancing Cultures, can be found at takagawaphoto.com. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
My next guest is Cheryl Head. She is the author of some exciting crime thrillers featuring an ensemble of characters but centered around a detective called Charlie Mack. Cheryl Head's latest entry in the series, which is the sixth Charlie Mack Motown mystery, is called Warn Me When It's Time. Cheryl A. Head, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary Shapiro. Happy to be on your show.
So this is the sixth in your series, but listeners can take it from me that they can just jump right in because I really enjoyed this book a lot and I haven't read the previous five books yet.
Okay, thank you.
But let's begin with getting some background. Who is Charlie Mack?
Well, Charlie Mack is a Black, bisexual private investigator who lives and works in Detroit, Michigan. And the series, the Charlie Mack Motown Mystery series, is set in Detroit in the mid-2000s. So the first book is in 2005, this most recent book, 2009. And Gary, I said it during that decade because it was a low point in Detroit's kind of socioeconomic, cultural trajectory. The mayor was under investigation by the FBI. The city was just years away from bankruptcy. The auto industry was in a free fall. Something like 41% of the population left the city between 2005 and 2010. So it was really at a low point in its life. And I thought, what a great time to set a series that's about crime and about mysteries. I'm from Detroit, so I love the city. But I was living in Washington, D.C. At that point, and I was thinking, what has happened to my city? So I wanted to have a positive, smart, empathetic, collaborative Black woman at the center of solving some of the domestic and other kinds of problems that came up through her agency. Because I knew from living in Detroit most of my adult life that there's a lot of problem solving done by Black women. And I think they're kind of our natural private investigators. So that's how I came to the story. And I wrote it kind of as a labor of love. It was a lot of fun to do. I had just come off writing a historical fiction piece that was really grueling in terms of research. And because I like the mystery genre so much, I thought, I'm just going to write a mystery for fun to entertain myself. And that's how I started with it.
Well, so because you are a Detroit native, yeah, there's a lot of food in the. So are all of those restaurants authentic restaurants?
Yes, they are. Yes, mm-hmm. they are. And they're new ones now. This was my memory of the restaurants that were there. Some of those restaurants are gone. But in 2019, there's a plethora of really good food there and lots of good ethnic food. Detroit's been always known for its ethnic food. And people talk to me, they go like, Charlie's in the middle of a crisis and they stop and have pizza. And I go, yeah. And the problem is, you know, we got to eat.
Yeah, I like it. The book definitely is not a book to read if you're dieting because there's a lot of talk a little bit about, you know, you approached it. She is not Philip Marlowe or Sam Spade. She's That's part true. Of an ensemble cast of characters.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you pick up on that. So I love Philip Marlowe and the Sam Spade characters. And I grew up really reading a lot of that noir mystery genre. I like Elmore Leonard. I like the noir, but I also think it's time that noir was shaken up a little bit because the world's different. But I use the tropes of the loner, the person who has his or her own code of ethics, you know, that kind of thing. But I put a spin on it, and because Charlie is who she is, which a lot of those attributes that the detectives in those 40s and 50s noir books have, Charlie has. But she also brings her worldview as a Black woman, and her sense of justice is slightly different than I think those characters were. Her sense of collaboration is different. So I try to use the tropes lovingly, but turn them on their head, because I think that's what's happening in the world of crime fiction right now, as more and more writers of color and other kinds of writers are taking on the genre.
So aside from issues of gender and color, which are which are inherently political nowadays,
yes,
I guess always, warn me when it's time is a political book. And so is our politics, is that an important element in your writing?
I think I'd say yes, but it's more about justice and how it's applied. And it's more about how police are reacting to crime and criminals. So it's not, one of the other books deals with politics, and I'm really interested in politics, and I live in Washington, D.C., the home of our politics, but it's not inherently a political series, but it is a series that will always deal with difference in class and race and tolerance and social justice and those kinds of issues in between eating. You know, and I'm looking at the world from this prism of what really does make America great. And I think it is its diversity. I don't think we've embraced it in the way we could to make our country the best it possibly could be. I believe in the ideals of this country as a Black woman. I'm as patriotic as anybody carrying any flag. I really am. But I also feel, because I love the country, I want to be a constant constructive critic. And I want to call out some things that don't seem equitable and right and based on the ideals that are in the Constitution, which I think is a wonderful document. A living, breathing document that was written with great kind of forethought and prescience, but still, when we apply it to today's problems, we have to consider the variations of our lives, the kind of people who live in America now, the pressures that the country has, and those kinds of things. I'm thinking about all that stuff when I'm writing.
And I think it shows through. That's what makes the books. Well, the one that I read anyway, so interesting. I mean, it was and we haven't even talked about like the plot, which is great and well written and twisty all the way to the end. But there's also a political, like you've said it in the early days of the Obama presidency.
Yes,
and it's interesting to hear how people felt about Obama at that time.
Yes.
Given what's happened. So, I mean, because you've said it you don't use any hindsight because it's happening as it's happening. But of course, we all know what happens.
That's right. I mean, the benefit I have is I know how it ends, you know.
Yeah.
But I got the idea for this book on two things. There was an FBI report written in 2009 that talks about the proliferation of hate groups. And the kind of critical mass of these alt-right groups growing across the country, much of it due to the Obama candidacy. So when I heard about this report, I thought, oh my goodness, who knew how many assassination attempts there had been and that kind of thing. This FBI report deals with that. And then last year, I hear about my beloved state, Michigan, having a conspiracy to kidnap the governor. So I was already on this track about writing about this period of time in Detroit and this growth of alt-right groups in southeastern Michigan, but that really pushed me over the edge. I thought, who are these people? What drives them to take such drastic and murderous action? You know, what's in their heads? What fears do they have? I really wanted to get inside the brains of some of these guys in a way that's not necessarily sympathetic, but in a way that doesn't presume that they're crazy, although I think the actions are crazy. But I think there's, I know that those kinds of people can exist in our midst, next door neighbors, guy at the restaurant, guy pumping the gas, person at the law library, they're everywhere. And I want to know, what is the fear? What is the fear driving those kinds of actions and the need to gather together with like-minded people to overthrow the country?
The political divide that we live in is not new to 2021 or 2020 or even 2016, but the people inside each of their bubbles strongly believe that they are right and that the things they believe in are right. And
yes,
you convey that in this story too, that these people who are criminals don't think of themselves as criminals.
No. And some of them don't commit crimes. I mean, some of the people in this group are extremists and do commit crimes. Others are members, like they might be members of the Kiwanis Club, but I did want to, there's one character in the book who I really wanted to see him as possibly being able to come out of that mindset and see the world differently. If he had the right kind of teachers around him, the right kind of role models around him, a different voice in his head other than these leaders of this hate crime group he belongs to.
And Charlie Mack seems to have because you talked about justice.
Yes.
She's able to, she's a very understanding investigator, I believe.
Yeah.
She understands. She's not necessarily motivated by her own political beliefs or.
Yeah, that's true. That's her quote. That's the trope of the PI with their code of honor. And her code is that she feels the world is a place where we can all be living together and thriving together. Her background in this series is that she's a former Homeland Security agent. In the first class of DHS agents, when DHS was trolling law schools for agents, for new agents. And she did out a sense of patriotism, a lot of us felt patriotic after 9/11, and she joined on with DHS, but very quickly became disenchanted with the procedures of racial profiling. She was serving in a class in Detroit where there's a large group of Arab Americans, some of them Muslim, some of them Christian. That's why I call them Arab Americans. And they were being racially profiled, especially after 9/11. And that didn't sit well with Charlie. And so that's why she left the agency to form the DHS to form her own private investigation agency. So she does bring a sense of her sense of justice to the work she does and her sense of what's right and what's wrong. And she, in her own small way, wants to correct that.
And she, her partner, she's got several people that work with her, but her main partner is kind of someone that was an unusual pick, I think, for her. And, and the shadow of 9/11 looms large in his life.
Yes. Don Rutkowski, who is by far my favorite character to write. And Don is an amalgam of the white men I've known in my life. Some of them have been nemesis and some of them have been mentors. I've had white male mentors who have really helped me a lot in my career. I came out of public broadcasting. But Don is in my head. And I think Don is kind of emblematic of some of the men, mostly white men, who join these groups. Don is able to be a foil to Charlie. He both emphasizes through his actions her sense of empathy, but also I think he teaches her some things about human nature that she might not normally come with. They are a pretty good team, actually. he's, you know, he's the Archie Bunker type. He's the one who's going to quickly come out with some inappropriate statement. He's very suspicious of most people, you know. He's not really adaptable when it comes to celebrating people's differences. And he'll call people out, but he's a good guy to have in a fight because he will pull out his gun and shoot when necessary. And Charlie will have second thoughts about that. So they teach each other through the course of this series. I think he begins to become a little softer around his views about different people through his work with Charlie and the other members of the team. And Charlie builds sort of an empathy for his way of thinking, his understanding that for Don Rutkowski, in a world that's changing dramatically around him, where majority populations are now brown and black in some cities and in some states, understanding that the country we all believe was the biggest and baddest and wealthiest and most wonderful country in the world might not necessarily be. He brings all of those fears about his place in the world and his place in this country and what's to be lost for them, what's at stake for them. And so she has an understanding of that, I think, that helps her makes her want to help Don rather than just decry his statements and his actions. So yeah, they're good partners and good foils for each other.
This novel, which is called Warn Me When It's Time, has a hate crime as the at the center of the story.
Yeah.
But you had to come up with so this is your sixth book in this series, so you have to come up with it's not just enough to tell the story of your characters and the crime they're solving, but I mean you have to come up with the crime and figure it out and how it's all gonna end. Do you have a lot of these rattling around in your head? Will there be 20 Charlie Mack stories or 40?
There are gonna be more, and I am this odd bird that thinks about, wow, what would a terrorist do if that happened? You know, where would they bury that body? Oh, look at that place. That would be a great place for a crime. I mean, I walk around every day. I'm not the most fun person to watch television with either. I'm going like, oh, that would never happen. Uh-huh. But I get my inspiration from little bits of information that I see or hear. For instance, the second book was about my thinking, what would happen in 2006 in Detroit if there were some terrorist attack being planned for the Detroit Auto Show, which is the biggest event in that city, the International Auto Show, held every year through my growing up in Detroit. Everybody comes to it. It's really a kind of event that has no race and class. Everybody wants to come and see the new cars. So it's a big deal for the city, and we dress it up and put on our best clothes and our best behavior. And that was also the year the Super Bowl was held, weeks after the auto show. And I thought, well, what would happen if they got wind of a plot against the auto show that really was a precursor for an event at the Super Bowl? What would happen? Who would be involved? Who would be upset? What would they do to protect the city's reputation or to keep those events intact? And so that's how I got started with that one. And it was also the first year that the Chinese nationals exhibited a car at the auto show. So I was off to the races with that around spying and Chinese spying against, at that point, it was automotive technology. There was lots of automotive technology that was being stolen. And it was a fun book to write. I got really deep in the weeds around conferences and what's behind the walls, because all that was part of protecting the event space and trying to get in front of this plot before it happened. And turned out, I think it's a good book.
Well, you know, it seems to me that this calls out for cinematic interpretation. You know, it should be a television series. I mean, for one thing, you've got an ensemble of characters that are all really interesting. Has anybody approached you about the rights to?
Yes, and I have been approached. I have what's called a shopping deal, which a producer is out taking it to various writers. It was kind of a hard time. It started in the year of COVID. So people were reading everything that was in front of them, but there was also what was happening was the Black Lives Matter movement. And so every script that has a police presence in it is being reinterpreted or at least being, you know, looked at with arm's length. So there was a little bit of concern about that, even though, as you will see in my series, Don, who's an ex-police officer, certainly has some connections to the police department, and that allows them to solve crimes they might not be able to solve in the agency. But it's not, definitely not pro-police, but it's not anti-police either. I mean, I think it realistically presents this institution that needs to be here to protect us, but needs to be reformed in a way that is much more in touch with what community policing is and what the qualifications of police officers should be and what the training needs to be. So that plays out in the series as well. Did I answer your question there?
I think you did.
Okay.
And so we might see it on our TV screens, and we might not.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed about it. I think it would make a really interesting series. There's so many platforms now, as you know, Gary, for, you know, we don't have just the big five networks anymore. We've got all these streaming services and cable services. And so I think it'll find a home eventually, because I think Charlie's an interesting character, and her cast of characters allows for some really interesting casting possibilities, and I think the topics are timely.
And the let me just ask you real quick about the publishing company that publishes your novels.
Yes.
They specialize in gender issue stories.
Yeah, and actually they call it lesbian fiction. And I got connected with them because the publisher came up to me at a reading. I'd written the first installment of the series and published it online, and she had read it, and I was selling copies of it on Amazon as an independent publisher. And she came up to me after a reading and she said, "I read your book, I like it." And I said, "Great, thank you." She says, "You think Charlie could be a lesbian?" And I said, "Well, yeah, she could probably be a lesbian. I hadn't thought about that because I'm a noir purist and there's very little romance in these books, you know."
Yeah.
I went back to my beta readers and they all said to a person, "Oh, we thought she was." So I went back to the publisher and said, "Yeah, I think I can reframe this for you." And so that's how the book got with this publisher who really specializes in lesfic. But the publisher and I have had lots of conversations about how the romantic elements of the book, you know, are not the most important elements for me. The mystery is the most important elements, but it does, I think, in a way that's really helpful to the genre of mystery writing, depict a protagonist who has a lifestyle that's different. So Charlie comes back to her partner, Mandy, at the end of the day, and they have a dog and they do all the stuff that people do who are in partnerships and relationships. And so that's an element of it, but it's usually a minor element of the, depending on the case, a minor element. However, her partner, Charlie's partner, Mandy, is a police officer. And so we will, occasionally see Mandy helping out in a case, and they have conversations about police and how they operate in communities.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's a real thriller, and I enjoyed it so much that I invited you to be on the show. The book is called Warn Me When It's Time, and the author, my guest, Cheryl Ahead. Cheryl, thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Show.
A pleasure to be here, Gary, and always happy to talk about the books, and thanks for your insightful questions.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.